Yeah, well, thank you for the introduction. One of the issues I was facing when I was thinking about how I'm going to talk about this today is that I've already given this talk a few times. And in fact, the very first time I gave this talk, well, not this talk, but a talk on the same subject, was a year ago in KATP China, where Vincent was one of the organizers. And so I want to use this opportunity to thank him for letting me speak twice at various venues which he's organized, and also Maciek and all the other organizers. Yes, and I also want to make sure that when I'm talking about this work, at least, that the work of Mike Hermele, or contribution of Mike Hermele and Anna-Maria Ray, is not forgotten. They played the key part in this work. In fact, a lot of what I'm going to be telling you was done almost single-handedly by Mike Hermele, so I want to emphasize that he's not here, but his spirit is present here in what I'm going to tell you. And one more thing, so my talk is about SU and magnetism, so now it's a rapidly developing topic, not just theoretically but also experimentally. In fact, our proposal to hold an SUN invited session at the APS March meeting has been accepted, so there's going to be an invited session in March, and I invite everybody to attend it. There's going to be lots of experimental talks, in fact more experimental talks than theory talks, so you maybe hear something which you won't hear about here today. Okay, and now let's see. Stick this in. So what are the things which I'll tell you about? First of all, I'll tell you that there is now a way to realize SUN symmetry almost with a very high accuracy using cold atoms, and I'll tell you how to do this, although some of you are probably already familiar with this. Some of you might have been at one of my talks before, and you know what I'm talking about. And so this is essentially a new world of SUN physics, which previously was not accessible. Previously it was old theory, now it's accessible to experimentalists. And so lots of old work which was done forgotten can now be revived. And you guys are all theorists, most of you are theorists, so I invite you to look at what was done and what has not yet been done, and maybe contribute to this new field. Finally, I'll tell you just there's one corner of SUN physics which we looked into precisely because, you know, even though people already explored SUN physics in the past, they didn't know about the possibility of realizing these things experimentally, so they were not motivated by the experiment. Once you start being motivated by experiment, you look in the corner of SUN physics nobody has ever thought about, just because they didn't know it was important. And if you look there, you discover something there which is theoretically very interesting. So we discovered that those SUN spin systems are chiral spin liquids, which is a state of magnetic systems postulated before but never really discovered, even in theoretical sense. Nobody pointed out a Hamiltonian which has this kind of behavior. And so I would say this is both an interesting result in itself and also an indication that there are other things hiding there which people have not thought about because there were no experiments. Now that there are experiments, if you look into this, you won't be just copying old results to the language which is clear to experimentalists, you will actually be discovering new stuff. And that was one of the things which we were lucky to discover. Okay, and so that's what I'll try to cover today. And first, I'll talk about SUN magnetism and where it comes from. So it comes from this type of atoms which were not cooled down before, but now several labs can successfully cool them down. So these are the atoms which are called either alkaline earth or alkaline earth-like atoms. They're the ones which typically have even number of electrons, well, specifically alkaline earths, they're from the second column of the periodic table, and they have two electrons in the outer shell. And then, so this is the structure of this, electronic structure of these atoms. So two electrons in the outer shell go into the S orbit, and their spins combine antisymmetrically. And so in the ground state of such atoms, there's no electronic spin. Electronic spin is zero. And that differs from what happens with alkali atoms, which were cooled down until recently in most of the cold atom experiments. So those usually have one electron in the outer shell, and so they do have electronic spin equal to 1/2. So these guys have no electronic spin. In the ground state, atoms arrange themselves like this. There's also an excited state of these atoms, which looks like this. You can promote one of the electrons into the p orbital in such a way that total angular momentum is now 1, because one electron sits in the p orbital. Total spin is also 1 because of some kind of Hund's rule, which I don't really know much about. And as a result, the electronic spin and electronic angular momentum still combine together into something which gives you total spin 0. In fact, if you remember quantum mechanics, the symbols here tell you, you know, what's happening. So this is the ground state where angular momentum is 0, spin is 0, and this is the excited state where angular momentum is 1, spin is 1, but the combined spin called J in atomic physics is 0. You know, these are the kind of things which I had to learn as a student, and I completely forgot. Now I have to relearn them from scratch again. Okay, so now what's so great about these kind of atoms? So they have no electronic angular momentum degrees of freedom. So the only angular momentum degree of freedom comes from the nucleus. So the nucleus might have a spin, and that spin, it's in some sense non-interacting, because it's very hard for nuclear spins to interact. There are some mechanisms for them to interact, but they're very weak. One of them is direct magnetic interaction between nuclear dipole magnets, but that's controlled by nuclear magneton, which is very weak. And so typically you can neglect with great accuracy this kind of interactions. You can think of the nuclear spin as not doing anything. It's just sitting there without interaction. And as a result, this nuclear spin can play the role of SUN spin, where N is equal, if the nuclear spin is equal to I, then the number of spin components is 2I plus 1, and 2I plus 1 becomes N. We actually heard that already in Ryan Barnett's talk a couple of days ago, where he mentioned that if you have some kind of large spin, there are many scattering lengths, but if somehow they all happen to be equal, then suddenly you have this enlarged symmetry. That's exactly what's happening here. Interaction between these atoms is not sensitive to what nuclear spin is doing, which means all scattering lengths are the same, and which means there is this SUN symmetry. So this was observed in these two papers, I think independently, and some of the authors of these papers, I think, are present here. Besides myself, there's maybe more people. Now there's an interesting twist on this story. So for this whole thing to work, you must work with fermionic atoms. You cannot do this with bosons. And this is because all bosons of such type will be so-called even-even nuclei, and even-even nuclei have nuclear spin equal to 0. So the bosons exist of this sort, alkaline Earth bosons, but they don't have any nuclear spin. By the way, here I have to tell you something which I always mention this when I give this talk. The fact that even-even nuclei have nuclear spin 0 is kind of obscure. You know, many physicists don't know this. Now, as a graduate student, I have to take an exam in nuclear physics, and David knows this. It's a kind of exam which most graduate students hate it, because it's some amount of material you have to learn which you think you will never have to use again. And then suddenly, when we were working on this, and people were telling me, oh, you know, you go through a periodic table, and every alkaline Earth boson has nuclear spin 0. And suddenly I realized there's one fact from nuclear physics I still remember, which is even-even nuclei have nuclear spin 0. Another question is why, but in nuclear physics, many questions cannot be answered to the degree how we would want to have them answered. So that's the fact of nuclear physics.
Is it true even for things that are radioactive?
I think no, so it's for stable, at least it's for ground state of this nuclei. So definitely you can have excited state where the I is non-zero, but they'll have some lifetime.
So the thing about it being restricted to fermions is really just having to do with the fact that you want to have a nuclear spin. If you got some isomeric nucleus that had non-zero spin for the boson, then you could do this for them too. Is that right? Or is there something else? Is there something more fundamental about the statistics?
No, I think it refers to stable nuclei. So they, and if they're bosons, they will be even-even because they have even number of electrons, so that automatically makes them even-even nuclei. And so then the nuclear spin will be 0. Now, in principle, you could imagine...
It can be 1 or 2.
No, in the ground state of this nuclei, it cannot, from what I know. You can imagine maybe other settings where there is some degree of freedom, not necessarily nuclear spin. Maybe it's a molecule that has some internal degrees of freedom such that interactions don't depend on this degree of freedom. Then it'll have the same type of physics which I'm about to describe. So some people are asking me maybe polar molecules could be good candidates. Yeah, that might be. So you need to look at the level structure of polar molecules and see if there are levels such that internal structure is different but interactions are exactly the same. Okay, so let's see what I can do with these things.
So for the polar molecules, I remember the symmetry is
not as good as this one. As here, you can get approximately exact, almost exact. Over there, probably, because the levels are not really degenerate.
Yeah, well, Andrew, I think, was telling me just a couple of days ago that as far as dipole interactions, they might be insensitive to some details of the internal structure of these molecules. And so if you're interested in dipole interactions, you might actually get degeneracy. Okay, but, well, maybe there are other situations when degeneracy is not as good, so I can't really speak for the molecules. So as far as atoms are concerned, here the degeneracy is very high. I mean, there is still some residual interactions, but typical number people quote, which you can check, that number makes sense, is 10 to the minus 6, so the electronic interactions versus direct nuclear interactions. And so the symmetry is preserved up to 10 to the minus 6. Let's use that as a ballpark estimate. Okay, so now what I want to do is I take this kind of atoms and put them on an optical lattice, and my favorites are strontium atoms. Their nuclear spin is 9.5, well, this is a fermionic isotope of strontium, so it has 10 internal nuclear spins. And so I place them on an optical lattice, let's say one per site, although I could also imagine doing other things. In this talk, I'll do one per site. And each such strontium atom is characterized essentially by a number, which is a projection of the nuclear spin on some chosen axis. And so each of them can be in 10 different states, because the nuclear spin is 9.5. And I try to show it by drawing arrows which point in different directions, you know, because I want to show that each atom, each strontium atom on an optical lattice can do its own things, and there are many different things it can do. That is depicted here by these arrows. And so this is kind of described by SUN symmetric Hubbert model. So I imagine there is a creation operator which creates an atom, strontium atom, on the side I with nuclear spin alpha. So alpha goes, in case of strontium atom, over 10 different values. In general, over n different values. So n is 2i plus 1, I is the nuclear spin. And we know that interactions don't depend on nuclear spin. So the atoms are going to hop on this lattice independently for each nuclear spin component. They just go from one side to another. And the interactions will be kind of density-density interaction. Again, there's no dependence on alpha and beta, no coefficients here in the sum which depend on alpha or beta. So this is total density of all atoms square, basically, on a given site. And now, well, we can study this kind of SUN symmetric Hubbert model, but for the purpose of this talk, I'll actually study the magnetism which results from this model. Namely, I'll allow spins to move, I'll put one spin on a site, and I'll crank up U so that it costs too much energy for two strontium atoms to occupy the same site. And that, as we all know, results in the Heisenberg model. So this is the Heisenberg model, which you can derive from this kind of process, second order perturbation theory from here, where J is T squared over U. And this is literally SUN spins interacting with each other. This is spin raising, spin lowering operator, and these are SUN spins, not SU2, because nuclear spin can change in an arbitrary way. You know, alpha can change into beta, no matter what alpha and beta are. If these were SU2 spin raising and lowering operator, they could only change the projection of the spin by one. These guys change by arbitrary amount. So that's why it's an SUN spin, or another way of seeing it, this is a SUN spin. And we can also see why it's SUN symmetric. Take any of these Fs, multiply them by this matrix, and nothing changes if it's an SUN matrix. You just rotate in the space of this nuclear spins. And so these are SUN spin interferomagnets. Okay. So you can have a SUN symmetric Hubbert model, you can have SUN symmetric antiferromagnets, or Heisenberg model, as people would call it. Now let me tell you that this is not a theoretical abstraction or some idea which some theorists have, so this is happening right now. And I know of three groups, maybe there are more, but I'm aware of three which are working on this. One group is in Rice University, and they already have degenerate Fermi gas of strontium 87 in their lab. And I believe they're right now working on placing those strontiums on an optical lattice. So very soon we'll hear about SUN symmetric Hubbert model from these guys. And there's a competing group in Innsbruck where Florian Schreck is the lead investigator, and they can also do degenerate strontium. They like to mix it with bosonic isotope of strontium, strontium 84, for various cooling reasons, but that isotope has nuclear spin equal to zero, as we know. But the interesting agent there is strontium 87. Also, unlike these guys, they can control the nuclear spin of this strontium atom. So they can prepare a certain percentage of strontium atom with this nuclear spin, you know, 9.5, 7.5, 5.5, all the possible 10 projections of the nuclear spin, and they know how to prepare those guys in various proportions. And I believe that they're also working on placing these on an optical lattice.
So those are not on lattice yet, right?
That's what?
So those experiments are not done on the lattice yet.
They are not done on the lattice yet, so but they're done on the continuum.
Without the lattice, do you still also have kind of interesting results, like some kind of possibilities?
Yeah. Sure. So you can study. You can study SUM Fermi liquid. You know, there is a SUM repulsion in one dimension. You can study SUM symmetric Lagrange liquid, which if they confine this to 1D, they could do that. But to confine to 1D, they need to turn on lattice, as we know. So it won't come at the same time. Okay, but there's one more group in Japan, and they actually do have a lattice already. So this is the paper, which is actually slightly earlier than the first two, but I couldn't find a published version of this paper, and I don't know exactly what's going on. So they're working with ytterbium 173, which is technically speaking not alkaline earth, but it has similar properties. Electronic spin is zero, and nuclear spin decouples. Nuclear spin here is 5/2, so you have SU6 symmetry. And in fact, these guys know this, they put it in their title that they have SU6 symmetry. They also work with ytterbium 171. Which is just has nuclear spin 1/2, so that's SU2 symmetry, which might not be as interesting, but they like to boast that they have both symmetries present. And now these guys place this on the lattice, although I think their temperature wasn't that low, but they claim that they can see this time of light picture, which clearly tells you that they have the lowest brillouin zone fields. Presumably it's not because they have a band insulator, because they'll have to place many of these per site. But it's just because they have, you know, they randomly fill some states within the lowest brillouin zone. So that's the kind of results which I know they've reported so far. And I'm sure, and this was half a year ago, so I'm sure there was some progress since then. Okay, so we see that all of this is happening right now, and lots of possibilities become available. Whatever was your favorite SUN model or SUN model you can find in the literature is now within reach. You know, SUN Hubbard model obviously is within reach. You can study SUN metal insulator transitions. You can study SUN symmetric integrable models. You know, those were already studied in the literature, kind of like an interesting generalization from SU2 to SUN. Suddenly now you can actually do experiments and check if they behave the way they do. SUN Lagrange liquid, for example. Also, there's a lot of literature. SUN interferomagnetism is something which I'll concentrate on, and I'm sure that it's possible to fill the blanks and add more stuff to study. If you like. But in any case, the thing which I want to advertise, first of all, is that SUN physics is now within reach, and it's no longer abstract as it was before. Well, maybe I should say there were some proposals to have SU4 physics in the condensed matter context. Usually it's some approximate SU4 symmetry. Now we have SUN as good as SU10, and the symmetry is, if not exact, then it's very close to being exact. Okay, so, but now for the rest of my talk, I'd like to talk about SUN interferomagnetism, because that was the first thing we looked into, and we discovered there's something there which, from purely theoretical standpoint, is new. Nobody thought about this before. And so, turns out that SUN interferomagnets were studied before. People studied them, but typically to better understand SU2 interferomagnets, because if you promote 2 to n, somehow algebra becomes simpler. And here are the two groups of people who are very famous for doing work along these lines. One of them is Sajdev and Reed, and the other is Affleck and Marston. They worked in the late 80s, and they studied SUN symmetric interferomagnets, mostly inspired by high-T superconductivity, which was just discovered at the time, and that was an SU2 interferomagnet. And so the first question which comes up, and which actually comes up in any of the topics you can possibly study when you start studying SUN, whether these guys already understand everything and they can tell us what will happen in the experiment if we manage to get an SUN interferomagnet. Well, but it turns out if you read their papers that they did not address the kind of questions which are relevant for current experiments. And I'll explain why. So the next part of my talk is to explain what they did which doesn't fit into what experimentalists are doing now. And it's, in some sense, it's good news. It means that we as theorists are still relevant. You know, we can come and do something because not everything was studied before. And again, you know, one of the reasons they didn't study the right type of model is because they were not thinking about experiment. They were just thinking about what kind of SUN physics they can look into. In fact, they were interested mostly in SU2 physics. And so to continue, I have to tell you briefly what happens with SU2 interferomagnets. So suppose I put spin 1/2 on a square lattice, and they interact interferomagnetically, then It's known that the ground state of this antiferromagnet is so-called Néel state. So this is a magnetically ordered state where spins alternate. They're not frozen the way it's shown on this picture, but I mean, they do fluctuate because this state is not an eigenstate of this Hamiltonian, but as we all know, on the average, this spin points up while this spin points down. So this was known for a long time, but you probably know that it took some time for people to agree that that was the states of the antiferromagnet in two dimensions, mostly because analytically you can't really derive this. My understanding, you can only confirm that this is true numerically and experimentally. And that's because it's hard to find the actual ground state of this Hamiltonian. But now I think everybody believes that this is the Néel state. And so this was the kind of antiferromagnet which was observed, for example, in high TC superconductors at exactly at half filling, so they get the SU2 interferomagnet in the same way how I showed strontium atoms would form SUN interferomagnets, and this will be this kind of Néel state. But now when people decided to generalize SU2 to SUN, they did it mostly because theories become more analytically tractable once you go to SUN. But there is a crucial difference between SU2 and SUN, which you encounter if you try to look into SUN models. And this is, if you take two SU2 spins, you can always combine them into a singlet if you want. So like this, you form an anti-symmetric combination of two spins, and this is a singlet. And somehow that was crucial for antiferromagnets, because imagine if there's only two spins coupled by an antiferromagnetic bond, well, what is the ground state? It is that singlet. The triplet will have high energy, and so somehow the building block of antiferromagnet in some sense is the singlet. And so when people decided to generalize SU2 to SUN, they decided to kind of keep this property. But it's not so easy, because if you take two SUN spins, they won't form a singlet. And actually, you need n SUN spins to be able to form a singlet. You don't have to form a singlet out of n SUN spins, but you have to have at least n. And you can see this, because if you take two SUN spins, it's essentially the same object as here, except alpha and beta now goes from 1 to n instead of 1 to 2 or up or down, like it's for SU2. So this kind of object, if you form it, anti-symmetric combination of two such spins, it's an anti-symmetric tensor, n by n tensor, which has n times n minus 1 over 2 components, so it's not a scalar, it has many components, unless n is 2. If n is 2, then it's 1, so there's only one component. If n is larger than 2, then has more components. So you can then take three of those guys and you'll form tensor rank 3 of a size n in every direction. And so it'll have this number of components, which again is 1 if n is 3, but it's not 1 if n is larger than 3. And eventually you have to go to n spins to form a scalar. So it's a completely anti-symmetric object formed out of n objects. Each alpha goes from 1 to n. And so that's clearly something which is completely new in SU1 physics compared to SU2. And the people who first worked on this problem, they said, we don't like this feature of SU1. They said, we're trying to build up an SU1 model because SU1 is more solvable than SU2. But we would like to keep the features of SU2, which we expect to happen in real physics, which is, for them, high TC superconductivity. We'd like to keep them intact. Well, now, obviously, what's happening with cold atoms is that we no longer have to pray to SU2. You know, we do have SUN, and so we can just study SUN. But if we'll go back, though, and look at what those people did, so all prior studies which those people did were designed in such a way that you could form singlets from nearby spins. And they were done in the following way. So instead of placing, in our language, one strontium atom on every side, they would actually place m strontium atoms on one side and n minus m strontium atoms on another side. And so here I show what it means to place several strontium atoms on one side. So here I have m strontium atoms sitting at a particular site, well, site I maybe. And so on a nearby site, I'll place n minus m strontium atoms. Notice that they'll automatically combine antisymmetrically because they're fermions. So I'll have one site with m antisymmetric objects and another site with n minus m antisymmetric objects. And together, they can form one big antisymmetric object, which is a scalar. And so Reed and Sachdev chose m to be equal to 1, and Marston and Affleck chose m to be equal to n over 2. But regardless, they came up with something where you can place, well, we can take two nearby sites and make them form a singlet, just like SU2 spins tend to do. And they've discovered.
You're trying to construct the nearest neighbor Hamiltonian. It also has to be a singlet. So what else do you
do? The nearest neighbor Hamiltonian. Well, the Hamiltonian is not a state, so Hamiltonian just says it's a product of spin.
The generators of SUN, so it's the same.
What is the total spin over all sides, but not with a spin on a given side or on two sides?
Hamiltonian is not a sum of single.
Hamiltonian is a product of two nearby sides on any two sides. So take all possible bonds and multiply those spins by each other. If Hamiltonian commuted with spins on every two sides, there would be lots of conservation laws. You just solve it. But you know, there is a reason why this Hamiltonian wasn't solved. Like in one dimension, it was solved by Beta, and that wasn't easy. So the total spin is conserved, but
Heisenberg is single, sum is single.
The total spin over all sides, but not on two sides. And I'm talking here about two sides, the ability of forming a singlet out of two sides. I'm not saying it's a ground state. I'm coming to what ground state is going to be, but I'm just saying it's a possibility for this kind of states to form singlets out of two sides.
I think the question is a little different, right?
Really?
I think you're saying that if I just write down the Heisenberg model for two sites, just one exchange interaction, that's of course a singlet because it's a scalar. But the spin operators on a single site, they transform in a different representation from the, but they're not in the one representation unless you went like spins on these constraints. They themselves are a tensor.
Okay, that's true. Is it better?
The problem has a solution to two sides, but not the process.
Okay, so what these guys did is they placed, well, one atom on one side and m atoms on one side, n minus m on nearby sites, and it turns out that in the limit when n goes to zero, you can solve this problem exactly. And that's what they did, and they discovered the ground state, which happens to be something called valence bond solid. So this is a picture of valence bond solids. You have m spins sitting here, well, m strontium ion spins sitting here, n minus m sitting here, and all together they actually do form a singlet. So it is literally a singlet out of these two guys, and a singlet out of these two guys, and so on. And this covers the entire lattice by these red bonds. And this happens to be the ground state of the Hamiltonian in the limit when n goes to infinity. It received the name of valence bond solid because these things, they're kind of valence bonds, so these spins are coupled in a sense of state, in the sense of the ground states. Now, of course, that only happens at infinite n, and so there was a question of what happens when n becomes less than infinity. So you can do some perturbation theory, 1 over n expansion, if n is large.
In the solid materials, as people here, you see this valence bond place, some of your materials?
Not. Well, the problem is if you introduce explicit dimerization, you can actually, if these bonds are stronger than these bonds, you can somehow design these things by breaking translation invariant explicitly. What I don't know is whether in a completely translationally symmetric materials anybody has done something which looked like valence bond solid. In fact, Leon and Chanky might know this because that's their field. But the question was, any materials which are valence bond solids without any explicit translation invariant breaking?
You can break translation dynamically because of phonons.
Yeah,
well, no, that I don't want to. Right.
Coupling of phonons. I don't think there are really any clear examples that don't arise from that. It's
okay.
Purely electronic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so then to get that, well, people haven't seen that experimentally. They've only seen it numerically and analytically at large n. So people did some numerical work. It's actually a very popular subject right now. And they've discovered, and I think there's a consensus among people doing numerics on these systems, is that for any m, if n is larger than 4, you always get this kind of valence bond states. And if n is smaller than 4, you get a nail state. And I think there's some debates about what happens when n is 4. And here it depends on who you talk to. But some people think that, at least for some m, that might be a spin liquid, which is another state. But I don't have an opinion on this subject.
So you're always talking about 2D bipartite lattice.
Yes. Let's talk about 2D square lattice, which is bipartite, and then there's no issue.
But then I have very bad intuition, maybe, but I have the intuition that when n goes to infinity, spin is very huge in a sense, and so it should be more classical, whereas this is not classical at all. So.
Well, so that actually has a very good answer, which is To get classical spins, you have to combine these little fundamental spins symmetrically. And here I'm combining them anti-symmetrically, which actually does not make them more classical. They remain very quantum. And you cannot do that with SU2. You know, with SU2, you combine two of them anti-symmetrically, you get a singlet. So these are some sort of anti-symmetric representations of SUN, which don't have an analog in SU2. You can also construct quasi-classical spins out of these objects by combining them symmetrically, and that's another story. So we can also talk about this. Okay, but so that's what.
Do you need to have on each of the pairs of sites, does it need to be M and N minus M, or does it need to simply add up to N on each pair for this to work?
It's all, well, for this to work, I would say all it needs is to add up to N. However, one thing you should probably do want to have is to have translational invariance. If you start scaling these around the lattice in some random way, I'm not sure what will happen, especially as N becomes larger and you have many possibilities for choosing different Ns in different ways. So as a theorist, my first, I'm saying that and I'm thinking whether there's any way to avoid that.
No. It would be a different kind, right?
Yes. And
if you had M and N minus N, the next one was L and N minus L, then what is that?
Yeah, notice by the way that here, this guy can couple with this guy, but it can also couple with this guy, and it spontaneously chooses which one to couple. So in your scenario, it won't be able to do this. So I would say that your scenario encourages them to actually form valence bond states more than in this scenario, where it's a little bit harder. They have to think a little bit before they can form the valence bond solid. But I don't know what will happen. I mean, whether really you will get some kind of a new phase if you just randomly scatter those guys around, those M's, or if you will. Well, obviously, you'll have to do it in such a way that two nearby sites still form a singlet. But I would say that, yeah, that needs to be looked into.
What energy is lowest? One or two?
One or two.
I mean,
different Hamiltonians.
Actually, which energy?
I mean, ground state.
There are two variational possibilities, M equal 1 and M equal N2 in the two papers.
Oh, you mean here?
Here.
So these are different models.
Different models.
You know, I put different number of atoms. I can do that by varying local chemical potential. Well, I don't know. Theoretically, there are many ways to place given number of atoms on a site. Experimentally, we can talk about how to do that.
So for each Hamiltonian, this particular method produces the lowest energy state?
Yes. What I'm saying is that you fix M to be something, whatever is your favorite M, could be anything between 1 and N, and then study what happens, what's the lowest energy state. And you discover, regardless of M, if N is less than 3, less than 4, you get Neel state. If N is larger than 4, you get valence bond solid. So 4 is a special case, and all of this is regardless of M, but you fix some M, and you, in principle, you should study each M independently, and it so happens that things don't depend on M, at least as far as the ground state is concerned. Okay, yeah?
So where does it come, this crystalline order from? So why can I not like rotate two of them in the other direction?
Yeah, it's broken symmetry. So there are four possibilities, and this thing decides, chooses one particular realization. It's spontaneous, so there's no reason for it to choose one.
So M equals to N over 2, at least, that we do 1 to N expansion. And otherwise, there are like huge number of degeneracy, large N.
So actually, I was under the impression that for M not being N over 2, you also get this. But maybe, because I think it was studied, actually read on such that definitely looked into it. And I believe that they also get this. Maybe it's not as conclusive?
That I'm not sure, but I'm sure for N put N, I mean, for N over 2, it shouldn't be how large it is. But for other M, I'm not exactly sure whether we have it.
Okay, there are definitely papers. So I can show you the papers which make claims about this. But maybe we can discuss that. I mean, this is not easy to actually establish what order.
10 minutes before you finish.
Yeah, that's the problem.
We already started discussion session anyway, so just
okay. This was already a discussion session.
Already
going on.
No, but we keep going.
Because look, I can go very fast, but I don't know how useful.
We already used the discussion anyway. Go ahead.
Yes. Okay, so let's see what I was going to say actually. I was going to say that all of this might not be relevant for us because experimentalists, it's hard for experimentalists to place more than two atoms on a site. In fact, I talked to experimentalists and they say that they can actually place more than two atoms and maybe Bill knows
maybe
more.
Maybe three or four, but it's hard to place 10.
Yes.
I'm not saying it's impossible, but...
Some lifetime issues and other stuff which comes out. So let's say that we can only place one or two. And in fact, if I'm an experimentalist, I'll probably start with one. I have my strontium atoms. Why wouldn't I place one atom on the side?
Why can't you place three or four?
Decay issues. Say.
Free body.
It's your field.
It depends on the structure of the side and so on.
Yeah, so I understand that it's not as bad as bringing them to Hertzsprung resonance. Then they'll decay. They'll still decay at some rate. Okay, but in any case, we'll also see actually that it's not going to save us. Well, no, it will save us. I think if you can place more, you might see those valence bond states. We'll see it at the end of my talk if I ever get to it. Still, as an experimentalist, I'll do the simplest thing. I'll put one atom on a site and I'll ask what happens. And it turns out this is the question which actually was not addressed. And so we found one paper by Dana Rovas, relatively recent paper in 2008, and then I always said, well, if you have one atom per site and n of them can form a singlet, and clearly these guys, they kind of want to form singlets because they're interferomagnets, so unless they form some sort of a Niel state, some sort of other state, what they'll do is maybe they'll form clusters, and each cluster contains n sites. So this is like a cartoon of a cluster with six sites, if n is equal to six, and maybe those clusters will cover my lattice, and maybe that's the ground state.
You're always talking to them.
Always in two dimensions. Now we can also talk about three dimensions, but SUN is a huge topic and I just want to zoom in on one problem on SUN. Okay, so well, maybe that's what happens. Maybe you get this N simplexes or N clusters where N sites form a singlet and those things cover the whole lattice, kind of patches, or I don't know how to describe them. Okay, and maybe that's the end of it, but somebody has to calculate this and actually see that that's what's happening. And, well, so for that you need to do some sort of calculation. And so I have actually three slides which talk about that Niel order is very unlikely in the systems. Now, I don't have a proof that it doesn't happen, but I have arguments why it doesn't happen. So in my experience, since we're going very slow, if I start doing this, this will be the last thing I'll say, so maybe I'll skip over it, so I'll just go quickly through the slides. It's a quasi-classical argument, in fact, precisely as Maciek was mentioning, combining spins symmetrically, forming arrows out of them, and noticing that the ground state has large degeneracy, so we don't think that these guys will be ordered. In fact, for n equal to 3, this is what I'll come to. That's my only conclusion here. So order is unlikely, although the case of SU3 spins with one atom per site was recently studied numerically by Andreas Leuchle and his collaborators, and they find that it's magnetically ordered. But all the same, as n is increasing, it's less and less likely that you'll get magnetic order.
So they found Niel order.
They found Niel-like order. I mean, now there are, it's n equal to 3, so these are not spin-up, spin-downs, they're like colors, you know, blue, green, red, and they order themselves in some
way. There is a, you can define an order brand.
Yeah.
And
this is long-range order. If there is red here, there's a good probability there's a red somewhere down the line. Okay, but that's only for n equal to 3. In fact, it's getting harder and harder numerically to increase n, and we believe that magnetic order will be destroyed eventually as n is increased. And so what can you do? Well, turns out there's only one thing we can do, which is follow Marston and Affleck's lead and try to do large N. But large N has to be done in a smart way. And that's because if I just imagine placing one atom on every site and take it N to infinity, probably I won't reach any interesting limit which I can probe analytically. And that's because the number of sites required to form a singlet will go to infinity too. And if this is a defining notion of what my state is doing, you know, as I increase n, I'll be going through sequence of ground states which don't converge to anything. They always change as I increase my n. And so we have this proposal, kind of almost trivial in some sense, but nobody has done that before, to put n over k atoms on each site. And so this is the kind of thing which every time I think about it, it gives me a headache. For some reason, it's hard to internalize what this means. And so I like to talk about it very slowly. So I say, I have strontium atoms, the spins are SU10, and I have one atom per site, and 10 atoms, or 10 sites, will form a singlet. Well, what I do now, theoretically, in my mind, I increase N to 20. Now I have SU20 symmetry, and I have two atoms on every site. I still need 10 sites to form a singlet. Now, then I'll go to 30. So my SUN is now SU30, and I have three atoms per site, and still need 10 sites to form a singlet. And then I take N to infinity. So that has a nice limit, and I can study this analytically, actually. So M is a number of atoms I have on every site. N is my SUN, and K is a number which I keep fixed. So originally M was 1, and K was N. So if I take strontium atoms, K is 10. But then I increase N and M to infinity, and I keep K to be equal to 10. So K is what N used to be before I started doing this procedure. So K is the experimentally accessible N, while M and N become free parameters, and I'll take them to infinity. And it turns out that if you go through this procedure, you will discover that as soon as K is larger than 4, so as soon as you begin with a symmetry which is SU5 and larger, you discover something which is called chiral spin liquid, which nobody has seen before. It was only proposed as a state and not as a Hamiltonian. And so for the first time, we have a Hamiltonian whose ground state is a chiral spin liquid. And so let me tell you a little bit how this is done. Well, that's exactly 45 minutes into my talk. Okay.
This is a little like the previous valence bond, except it's now rotational and translational.
Well, it breaks translational, and I mean, it breaks all sorts of, it doesn't break all sorts of symmetries. The only symmetry it breaks is time reversal and parity. It keeps a lot of symmetries. And so in that sense, it's different from valence bond, which breaks translational.
You also do you also want more sites other than just two?
Do you need, your thermodynamic limit, so you have to have a very large system.
For the order parameter, like the local order parameter.
Yes, there is a certain order parameter which consists of three sites, although I'm very happy to debate whether this is an order parameter or not, because it's a topological state, and there are some issues having to do with this. Okay, and so here in this slide, I was explaining how this is done. In fact, this parallels very closely to what Affleck and Marston did. So in some sense, it's nothing new. It just changes what they did in a way that they didn't anticipate.
You want anti-fermi this because you have a minus now?
Yeah, but what I did here is I commuted some Fs through. So notice alpha, alpha here, beta, beta here. So if you bring alpha to beta, and beta, if you bring fermions on the same side together, you'll get a plus sign. And so you start with this Hamiltonian, you actually have to stick this N here. And then what you do, the common thing in this subject, you decouple this with a Hubbard-Sartorovich field chi. And now it couples to fermions, which if you'll see, they hop on the lattice with this chi. So here they were not hopping, they were just interacting. But here they're now hopping. So of course there is this guy, which if you integrate this out, gives you back this. You also ensure that you have N over K fermions on every site, because you'll be taking N to infinity. And so once you have this kind of action, you write down saddle point equation for this chi. And you can observe that if you look at this action, every terminate is proportional to n. And as a result, in a larger limit, this is a very nice saddle point, which you can honestly write. There's no, the only approximation is large n. There is no other assumptions going into this. And so, well, you can write down saddle point equations. You know, if you vary this with respect to chi, basically that's what you'll get. That chi coming from here is equal to this. That's for a given alpha or over n if you sum over alpha. And so what this means is that this chi is like a dynamically generated hopping for these fermions. And this hopping adjusts itself as to minimize the energy of these fermions. And so if you could solve these equations with this condition that you have so many fermions per site, this is given for, this is written for one species. If you sum over n, it's going to be n over k. Then what you need to do is to experiment fluctuations. You'll write your chi as some kind of saddle point chi plus fluctuations. And it's well known in this business that the main fluctuations come from phases of chi, not from amplitude. Amplitude fluctuations are massive. Phases, well, they might also be massive, but at least they're softer. And so you write down, you concentrate on fluctuations due to phases, and that looks just like a gauge field. That's in fact how gauge fields appear in this context. Every time you study spin liquids or anything having to do with spins, this gauge field appears, and you can derive effective action for this gauge field. And so this is the route you have to take. Solve this, solve that, write this, find effective action. In fact, this is how Affleck and Marsden derived their valence bond solid. And so here is, by the way, how you do it in practice. There is another way of looking at it, which I think is intuitively more clear than what I've said before. You write down the Hamiltonian for some chi. So fermions moving in with some Hopping chi with this additional term. And you impose that this Hamiltonian is such that you have on the average n over k particles on every site. And then what you do is you, what you have to do is you, for a given chi, you want to find the ground state of these Hamiltonians. So given chi creates some sort of band structure. The Hamiltonians move in the lattice with some special Hoppings. They can be anything you can possibly imagine. They can vary in space in some way. They result in some sort of level structure. You fill all the lowest energy levels by fermions, as you always do when you're trying to minimize energy. And that gives you some energy for this guy. But then there's also the energy coming from here, and you try to minimize them together now. You have to minimize with respect to chi. And you can see it's not an easy problem, because part of it is given some completely arbitrary Hoppings. What's happening? Oh. I have to plug my computer. So, given some arbitrary Hoppings, you need to find the ground state energy of these fermions. Where can I plug it? Okay, maybe you can do it.
No.
I should have done that before the talk. But okay.
No, there should be something on the
back. Well, that's fine, but it won't show. No, it's a feature of Keynote that Keynote refuses to display anything on the board until. Until you plug it in.
So is it clear that the solution is our translation variant?
What's it again?
Is it clear that the solution is our translation variant?
No, it might not be translation. In fact, that's how you get valence bond states. So you need to find some chi's, or arbitrary chi. You need to solve for band structure over those chi's. You need to fill lower states up to this density. By fermions, you need to find the ground state energy, you need to add this to it, and then minimize with respect to all chi's. So this is hard. In fact, that's why it's not so easy to do, but what helps us is a certain bound, which Mike Hermel approved, and he generalized lower earlier bound proved by Rockstar in the case of k being equal to 2 in the context of Affleck Marsden. And so this energy is always larger than this quantity. And I mean, we could spend an hour talking about where this comes from. It's a pretty non-trivial bound, and it turns out to be very useful. So if you, for example, find some configuration of chi, and you calculate the energy which comes from this, you can check whether, if it's, for example, if it's equal or larger. If it's equal, you know that is the lowest energy configuration. If it's larger, there might be another one which is smaller. Okay, and so now, let's say I know what I need to solve. Suppose I start solving. So first I'll solve k equal 2 k's, and actually that was solved by Affleck and Marsden. So it turns out that all these chi's are such that the bonds which are here colored with green, they're the ones for which chi is non-zero and equal to some value. And they're all the same on every such green bond. All other bonds, chi is equal to zero. And you can prove that this configuration, in fact, satisfies that bound which I had on the previous slide. And so you know that's the lowest energy configuration. Well, of course, you can. In fact, what you cannot prove is that they form this kind of nice lattice. So in principle, they can be scattered all over the place. As long as every two sides belong to some kind of bond, this is fine. So, well, that's what Jenke was referring to earlier, that at least in the in k equal to k, you can actually prove by doing one over n expansion that this configuration is selected as the lowest energy configuration. And that's exactly the valence bond solid. You can argue that wherever you see fermions can hop, that's where the singlets form. And so these are singlets. Okay, but now you can go to k larger than 2, and this was something which nobody has ever done before. And you do it for k equal to 3, and you think, well, maybe there are k or 3 simplexes, according to Arovas. What you discover is that somehow 3 sides on a square lattice don't want to form a singlet, but 6 sides do. Then 3 sides will form a singlet. In fact, one thing you can prove, that if you live in a lattice which is breakable into clusters, within each cluster, all sides talk to each other, kind of maximally connected graph, then you will always get, no matter what k is, one of these cluster states. Okay, but on a square lattice, if k is equal to 3, it turns out you get this kind of object. So all these are non-zero, chi's are non-zero, the rest of chi's are zero. There's an extra feature here, there's actually a flux pi going through this guy, which Well, it's important for the solution, but you don't have to know it to understand the message which this is sending. So this is some sort of a cluster state. Okay, now we go to k equal to 4, and again, this time it's more natural. You discover there are squares. And so these guys form singlets, everybody else, those guys between those singlets, they don't talk to each other. And all the three configurations, they actually satisfy the bound, which I had in the previous slide. So you know that this is the lowest energy configuration. And now funny things start happening when you go to k equal to 5. So first of all, you discover that there are no configurations which satisfy the bound. And after a lot of work,
Can you also prove this from the solid? It's kind of a solid. It's like a Venus bond, that's a Venus bond solid.
Yes. So this is something for which you need to do 1 over n expansion, which we have not done in cases k equal to 3 and 4. So it's an open question. So you can do this. It's in some sense, it just follows what people has already done. So it shouldn't be very difficult, and you should be able to see whether it's a solid or it's something else. But as I said, new field, so many questions you can possibly ask, and all of them are open, and I invite everybody to join and study these questions. Okay, but so what we've discovered happens if k is larger than 4, is that fermions minimize the energy not by forming clusters, but by generating a magnetic field. So chi is no longer real, it becomes complex in such a way that you have a flux 2 pi over k per plaquette. So this kind of fluxes, as we all know from Hofstadter butterfly picture, they break everything into bands, that is actually exactly k bands, and if you count how many fermions you have, you actually fill the lowest bands. It's a very energetically favorable for these fermions to do, because then there's a gap to the next fermions. Now that is not, unfortunately, I can't calculate the ground state energy for this, because there's no analytic formula for the for the total energy of a field lowest lambda level on a lattice. But I can give all sorts of arguments why this is the best you can do on a square lattice. In addition, we also did numerics. So you can actually study that Hamiltonian numerically, generate some chi's, calculate the ground state energy by filling fermions, by fermions the levels which appear in this way, and then try to move those chi's in such a way as to try to go towards lowering the energy. And each time you do this, you always end up with this kind of thing. And so the ultimate arbiter here, I think, is numerics. And so there's no mathematical proof that this is so, but there is lots of evidence, including solid numerical evidence, that that's the kind of ground state you get. 5 minutes. Okay, so 5 minutes is for Carlos convection. So you end up with the ground state, which is the magnetic field. And now here I have to tell you that people speculated for a long time what would have happened if you went through the procedure I've just described and discovered that the subtle point is a magnetic field. In fact, if you took the book by Eduardo Fratkin, he has 2 or 3 chapters in this book talking exactly about this, but he just didn't know what spin system you should take to get magnetic field. Because once people knew, they would always get those clusters. They wouldn't get magnetic fields. But here now we know that there's magnetic fields, and so it immediately leads to something called chiral spin liquid, which was proposed by Kalmar and Laughlin, and maybe a year later by Wen Wilczek and Zee, and one of these people is here in this audience right now. And in fact, I don't quite understand the arguments of these guys. They were relying on the analogy with quantum Hall effect. The arguments of these guys are very similar to what we just saw. And so I recommend reading their paper. So it's a state of magnets without any magnetic order, and so it's spin liquid because of this. It doesn't break any symmetries, but it breaks parity and time reversal invariance, and it has to be described by Chern-Simons theory. And so local Hamiltonians whose ground state would be chiral spin liquid, I think it would be honest to say, or fair to say, that they were not known until now. There were some Hamiltonians which involved long-range spin interactions, but not local Hamiltonians experimentally realizable. And so to see that this is chiral spin liquid, what you have to do is you have to say, well, let's say that there's hoppings, which are magnetic fields, but it's a quantum magnetic field. You add fluctuations and you integrate out fermions. And it's a pretty straightforward exercise to show that once you integrate out fermions, the resulting effective action for these fluctuations in the Chern-Simons theory on level n.
Okay.
So in fact, k disappears. So k controls the magnetic field. The level is n, and you can see this because I have it's a large n expansion, so I should have an action with n in front. So this is the n. It has to be there. So it's a kind of a funny thing, though, because n is taken to infinity. So it's a Chern-Simons theory with a very large n. But let's say that n is not infinite, it's just large, but not very large. And because Chern-Simon theory, they tend to be stable, they're gapful, I would imagine that not just n equal to infinity is Chern-Simon theory, probably there's some neighborhood of n's for which we still have Chern-Simon theory. And so those will have fractional statistics with this, the excitations will have fractional statistics with this fractional angle coming from this Chern-Simon theory. So here, just in case, I explain what fractional statistics is, but I think everybody knows this. And so one question which comes up, especially since I should finish fairly soon, is how do you observe fractional statistics here? Well, the problem is that the spin operator is a bilinear in fermions, and it's fermions which couple to this Chern-Simon field. So spin operator is neutral as far as these guys are concerned, but one proposal which we have is to follow Lee and Nagaosa, introduce holes in the system, so remove some strontium atoms, for example, and then these holes can be decomposed into a holon and a spinon, a very common thing in high-DC literature, except here you can kind of do it in larger limit where things are more justified than just hand-waving stuff. And so I prepared a slide which normally I don't show, which actually shows how to do it in practice. So if there are holes, you get TJ model instead of just Heisenberg model. So your fermions can move around. And so you want to impose the fact that there are holes by adding bosons, the holons. So if you create a hole, you remove a fermion, but you add a boson instead. And so then you can write down this more detailed Hamiltonian, which say when a fermion moves to an empty side, that's the same as the hole moving in the opposite direction, and that's what this is describing. There's some extra term which you probably want to remove. And so you can also see that if you decouple these guys to the Hubbard-Sutton-Lynch field, then as far as C's are concerned, you get exactly the same action as before, as I had without those B's. You know, if you just set formally B to zero, what remains is exactly the thing I had before. And so you can integrate out C's, and therefore the Hubbard-Sutton-Lynch field, which decouples this guy, you get exactly the same thing, the same magnetic field and Chern-Simon field. But now these are the B objects, the holons, which move in this field. So in other words, the holes will be coupled to Chern-Simon field. So the spins are not coupled to Chern-Simon field, but the holes in your Hubbard model will be. So what do you do now? Here is the prescription to observe fractional statistics in an experiment. Increase the potential on some sites that expel the strontium atom from there, but actually breaks into a holon and a spinon, and spinon disappears and holon remain, and this guy is fractional. Now if you can move your potential from one side to another, well, you can break those things, and you know, then we can talk about actually how to interfere them and see fractional statistics. Okay, and one thing which I have to say, even though I know no time as always, is that it's very easy to generalize that and get 2 minutes.
Minus two minutes.
Okay. Discussion. We're having discussion because somebody asked me a question whether you can have non-abelian statistics or that, not just abelian statistics. And the answer to it is yes. All you need to do is to use two internal species of strontium atoms, both this guy and this guy. That's the only purpose I introduced them in the beginning. And if you put them on one side and you put them in symmetric combination, there's another question whether they'll want to go in symmetric combination or not, you can essentially see that the Hamiltonian becomes exactly the same thing as before, except now you have an additional index which goes over the species. So A and B is an index goes over one or two, which labels either this state of strontium atom or this. And it's kind of an additional SU2 thing. If you go through that same algebra, all you have to do is copy everything I've done, but with an additional index AB, in the end of the day, you'll get a SU2 Chern-Simon theory. And it's going to be SU2 level N, non-abelian Chern-Simon theory, and you will get non-abelian statistics. And notice that it will be SU2 level 10 if this is strontium atoms. And so here, I mean, I like this fact because people concentrate so much on weaker non-abelian statistics, especially SU2 level 2, that, well, usually I give this talk to people who don't know much about this, or know a little bit, but not that much. So I tell them a little bit about what non-abelian statistics is, but everybody here knows. And I tell them that Bill Gates likes non-abelian statistics because of microassociation Q. But everybody likes to talk about SU2 level 2, Pfaffian state and quantum Hall effects, and these days people talk about topological insulators placed on top of a superconductor and all these kind of things, but these are all Majorana fermions SU2 level 2 statistics, which is in fact not universal enough to have topological quantum computing, but I can offer them SU2 level 10, and sounds like they should get excited. So they're just across the street here, and I hope they're really excited right now. Okay, And so that essentially concludes all I wanted to say, except one thing. I want to show this phase diagram. I like showing it. And this is the new improved version of this phase diagram if you've seen it before. I go back to the non-abelian case because I understand it more. And I want to talk about whether, do we really know this is what happens in the experiment? Or what will happen in the experiment? Chiral spin liquid or something else? And so here is a phase diagram where here I'm writing how many atoms per site I'm going to place. Maybe one or two or three or more. And here I'm writing K, which is M divided by M. It's a little intuitively not clear, you know, what this thing is, because we know what n is. If we have strontium atoms, n is 10, or up to 10. K, you just have to divide and figure out what k is. But it's better to plot it in the km variables rather than nm variables, because the picture will be more kind of screwed up if I do it in the nm variables. And so what do we know? Well, we know that if k is 2, which means, for example, SU2 with one atom per site, it's here, that's Néel state. And then if you start increasing number of atoms per site, and simultaneously n, while keeping 2. So 2 is, let me appeal again to the picture of how many sites I need to form a singlet. So if I have 2 sites to form a singlet, I'm on this line. 3 sites to form a singlet, I'm on this line, and so on. So that is where we get valence bond solid. In fact, this line is what was calculated before. So Affleck and Marston at very large M, and numerically we know that there's a transition which happens somewhere around here, although this may be a special point. Okay, now what else do we know? Well, we know that if I start increasing k and go beyond 4, and if m is very large, I'll get chiral spin liquids. But in the experiment, I can only have 1 atom per site or 2, and m cannot be larger than 10. And so the green dots are the ones which are experimentally feasible. In fact, if I could place 3 atoms per site, maybe these 2 should also be colored green, but they're fully within valence bond solid. And so that's, I think, how you could possibly observe valence bond solid if you're here. 3 atoms per site and, well, n equal to 10, for example, or at 9, maybe. You can do 9, by the way, even with strontium, just by not populating one nuclear spin component. Okay, and so the rest depends on the phase boundaries. So this is the, let's say, potential experiment is here, although maybe also with these two guys, if you want to consider 3 atoms per site. But what happens with these phase boundaries? Well, maybe they're just like this. Wouldn't that be good? And then you can do computing here. And so this is a picture of Bill Gates, who gets happy because he can do topological quantum computing. But now it's possible that maybe phase boundaries are different. Maybe they go vertical like this. Then what it means, you have a Néel state here. And then nothing interesting happens in experimental accessible regime, maybe here, for example, for strontium. Except I had those slides I skipped where I said that Néel order is unlikely, so this is probably not going to happen. Another possibility, which is more likely, that maybe this is a valence bond kind of state. And maybe that's not as boring as Néel state. Well, I don't know. But at least these are definitely experimental accessible all the way to here. Well, I hope that chiral spin liquid can actually be, that there is no phase boundary going like this, and there is chiral spin liquid in this area. But the only way to check that is numerically, and so here I have to ask our colleagues who can do numerics, who all tell me there's a sign problem, and they cannot solve this problem. And so that, I don't know yet. But that essentially brings me to my conclusions. So I have two quite separate messages. One of them, we have now these SUN experiments. Lots of questions we can ask. Many of them are unexplored. So let's work on this topic. And second, just let's take one topic, SUN interferomagnetism, which, by the way, experimentally might be difficult to achieve because of the temperature issues, as we all know. But if people will be able to probe, let's say, Néel order for SU2 systems, they may be able to probe the kind of physics I've described. Although, as I said, I've only shown that these guys are chiral spin liquids in a certain limit, which is not directly accessible to experiment, but probably closer to the experiment than, you know, interferomagnets for SU2 are. Okay, so let me stop here.
I think we're running a little late. We're going to do the form in practice. 20 seconds break and take a break. And anyone wants to leave, feel free to disappear. You know, we have a coffee, you know, 20 seconds. Anybody wants to disappear, feel free to disappear. Anyone wants to leave, feel free. Otherwise, we continue. Questions?
I have a comment because I also don't understand the Kalmayer and Laughlin as well. But what I understand is that they take both a Harvard model and they flip the sign of the tunneling and they show that on the triangular lattice, in this case, this is equivalent to certain value of magnetic flux by a gauge transformation through the triangles. And then they say that in the limit of strong interactions of boson, this is equivalent to the Heisenberg antiferromagnet, which is frustrated, and then they make this analogy between the Laplacian states in the fractional hull and the frustrated resonance and boson state. I understand that this is the paper that you're talking about.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yes.
So the only message that I wanted to have is that there are people who try to flip the sign of tunneling in both the Hubbard model, which is Klaus Zengstock in Hamburg, by making some kind of dynamical movements, which is also with the hope to reach spin liquid state.
But you mean the sign of Hoppings,
sign
right?
Of Hoppings.
Well, we can probably look at the top of the band, right?
Place not the exactly. The it's this, kind of this lattice shaking method, okay. In which when you go to time dependent system, then you got an average somehow the change, the effective change. One experiment in this style has been done by Arimondo in the square lattice, but in the square lattice this is nothing interesting because it's a square lattice.
Well, that also.
The very important thing is that changing the sign is equivalent to magnetic field.
Okay, well.
The triangular because of frustration. You cannot kill this line.
So, about changing sign, I would say there's also another way. You can work with those doublons. You know, people like to discuss doublons, and those are seen experimentally. And so they'll change the sign. But also, as far as I understand, as far as Kalmayer-Laughlin, it's not like if you do this, you'll get Kalmayer-Laughlin state. I think Kalmayer-Laughlin state is a variational. It's a variational state, which is the possibility.
Exactly. This is not. This is what I'm saying. It's not clear.
In these systems, you have that the relative not only the magnetization, but the population of each one of the components is a conserved quantity.
Right.
So this means that you have to minimize your system in a very specific manifold of 10 different numbers, which have to be conserved. In an experiment, I would expect that this will make very difficult to observe.
Well, okay, so that depends on how precise you need to adjust those numbers. So the kind of state we get is completely symmetric, which means it's equal population in each of the spin components. Now, in practice, you can prepare, you know, as many as you want, and you can make them approximately equal. And we believe that if this is chiral spin liquid, well, it has a gap, which means you can perturb it a little bit, and nothing will change. So you can do it with some accuracy. Now, I cannot tell you exactly with what accuracy. There's going to be some range.
There will be a special region in which you will have this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that I'm completely sure of. So you won't have to have precisely, you know. 10,000 atoms in this nucleus state, 10,000 in this nucleus state, and altogether precisely 1 million atoms. These numbers can vary within some reason. Now, within which reason, unfortunately, you need to do numerics or a real experiment to see what will happen.
Fine, so you're getting the chiral spin liquid within the assumption that all the parameters should be formed out of biquadratic combinations of fermions. But if you form higher order combinations, say it would be order parameter of triplets, quadruplets, and so on, is there a guarantee that it still be chiral spin liquid or it will get some order?
I'm not sure I actually understand this. I don't have any assumptions about order parameter forming out of two.
No, you take
the larger limit.
But if you take
the larger limit,
four times, five.
That was a part of this settle point approximation, that you need to calculate some average of what two fermions are doing.
How with respect to introducing higher order fermions?
Well, so, right, it depends on your point of view.
But if you go to finite, of course, it cannot be sure if it's not true.
Well, I could give a more... Well, a longer answer, and you can add extra terms to this Hamiltonian in principle, and you might argue that they naturally come from strong zoom atoms, but you would say it depends how strong they are. If they're sufficiently weak, they won't do anything. But it's not another parameter, it will be just terms in the Hamiltonian.
No, you don't need to, you will be generating terms in the Hamiltonian dynamically, so you can presume that you have order parameter, whatever order you need to get this order parameter, but how stable system is if you say, okay, analogy would be you form, let's say, molecules out of 3, 4, 5 fermions. You allow this process to happen.
Okay, but look, so in what I'm doing, I'm not allowing or disallowing anything. So I have a model, and within that model, I can solve it.
But is it possible to check?
I think, I mean, you, in some sense, you do generate additional terms, and these might be the terms which will be important as n is reduced. But as n goes to infinity, that's what you have. You have chiral spin liquid. I think that's the best answer I can give.
What's the situation in 1D? Does anything happen really interesting as a function of n?
So in 1D, precisely the kind of model which we, which I've described here was studied by Affleck, and I believe it's an SUN level 1 larger liquid. So, you know, SUN level 1, that's the mean of Witten model.
So it's the same type of
liquid. Yes. So in fact, both models...
For one form and per side, mm-hmm. you have more than the SUN level something.
And in fact, a variety of these models was solved exactly by Sutherland in 1975. There's this very comprehensive paper. You can extract all sorts of different things. And that's one of the things you can extract from this paper.
I'm going to reduce my power to the chair. That's one question. So you're talking about the nuclear spins, right?
Yes.
What about the energy scale? To, you know, there's no temperature axis in the phase size of it. So you talk to Bill Gates, okay, he's asking what temperature it does below because the nuclear spin is weak.
Well, but notice that nuclear spin doesn't give you the scale. The scale is interaction scale, which comes from electronics. It's an electronic scale. Well, I can...
The energy scale is the same as
square
over
U. I do this. Yeah, it's T square over U. Let me try to show, to just go back to the Hubbard model. Where it is? Is it here?
You don't have anything to do with magnetic cycles interaction.
But the spin is only about statistics, isn't it?
I mean, yeah, so look.
Interactions are the same as
G. Yeah, so look. These are the interactions. Interactions don't care whether you have spin or not.
Okay.
I mean, the spin is just sum over it, just like a spectator. Interactions come from electronic degrees of freedom. Yeah, but of course there is a, this effect. What I've been telling you about has the same energy scale as, you know, Néel magnetism in SU2 systems, which is what people can't observe because they cannot go to low enough temperature. So there's going to be the same roadblock here. You only take those strontium atoms and cool them down to T square over U temperature. It's also possible that the actual scale for chiral spin liquid is lower. There could be some number. It's not just T square over U. It's T square over U times 100. Who knows?
But it's not the temperature. It's the entropy per spin. I mean, that's certainly the crucial quantity you need to be looking at.
Well, you definitely need to lower the temperature, at least below T square over U, but I would imagine actually way below T square over U. And to tell you by how much I need to do numerics, and that's what people tell me they cannot do if n is larger than 3. Or maybe they'll do it eventually.
How robust are your results to a system that might have a fractional number of atoms per side?
Well, so one of the issues here is, you know, one of the ways to approach this would be to start with the lattice when I have integer number of atoms per side and start removing some atoms, but not all. And now it depends. So one very alluring possibility is that if you start with a chiral spin liquid state and you remove some fraction of the atoms, well, those holes are going to be anions, and so then they'll form what people call anion superconductivity. So they'll form a superconductor. It's a very natural scenario. Now, whether this will occur all the way until you go to the next filling fraction, that I don't know, probably not. So there's going to be some transition to different types of anions. Maybe there are other scenarios of what will happen. In any case, this would be a TGA model, which is harder to study.
I said a question about, so you derive this Schoen-Simons term in the large n limit, in the n equals infinity limit, right? But at the n equals infinity limit, there's no fractional statistics because the fractional phase is pi over infinity is zero. Have you sort of systematically done one of rank corrections to see that, you know, there really is fractional statistics at finite n?
Well, so Schoen-Simons term is one over n correction. That's why it has n in front.
Doesn't the entire action have n in front of it?
Right, and that's what it means, that it's a 1 over n correction. There's actually, you can study other corrections. For example, you expect that there's going to be a whole bunch of terms, all of the order of n, being having the form of gradient expansion. So Schoen-Simons term has the lowest number of gradients. The next one is a Maxwell term. So Maxwell term is definitely there, and that's what controls the gaps. It might be important to know what it is, but it's hard to calculate in the lattice. And then there's our n square and high order terms. No, not n, sorry. There will be 1 over n corrections to this. And so you could start calculating those also, but they will be small compared to these terms.
More questions?
Oh, we
we are grabbing the copy.
Okay, thanks.